This is the House Judiciary Committee, June 12th, 1985, full committee.
Judiciary Committee will come to order, please. We've got a long agenda, obviously. Full committee is our first word priority. Then both subcommittees are going to be meeting this afternoon, Subcommittee 1 first and then Subcommittee 2. We've got floor session at 3:15, so we're going to be probably called down to the floor, at least on that occasion. Hopefully we'll be excused. Hopefully we'll finish full committee work by that time. And we'll try to continue to work through the afternoon and into the evening to finish our agenda, both full committee and both subcommittees. We're going to start out with a brief hearing. We've got three witnesses on Senate Bill 328. First individual up is Janet Hawkins. And this is scheduled for hearing and work session today in full committee. This has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, and that's the reason that it was placed directly before the full committee for hearing and work session, in order to permit expeditious consideration and re-referral if that is the will of the committee. And this is also at the special request of the chief sponsor, Senator Hamby.
Senator who?
Hamby. Go ahead.
Hi. Members of the committee, my name is Janet Hawkins. My address is 1945 Royal Street, Northeast. I'm here today representing Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I'm staff in EMO's legislative office. Senate Bill 328 is a positive step. Its proposed checkoff enables citizens to join together in supporting programs providing alternatives to violence. This would reduce the frustration of not knowing what to do about violence, and these funds would give the opportunity for creative programs to be begun in local communities on a local level. Some of the examples of programs that would provide alternatives to violence would be neighborhood mediation programs. As an attachment, you have a couple of newspaper articles on local programs. And one is our Salem program that's just being begun here. We have very little funding at this point. There are neighborhood mediation programs in Portland, one in Eugene that's now struggling for funding, and then a proposed Portland program in the Burnside area. We encourage your positive vote for Senate Bill 328. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Hawkins?
Why wasn't it sent directly to Revenue?
I don't know why it came here before going to Revenue. Okay. If not, thank you very much. Anita Paulson?
My name is Anita Paulson. I represent the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and today I'm not wearing my legal aid lawyer hat. The coalition just asked me to come and say a few words. They would really like to see this bill happen. For example, there's a program in Medford called Men's Alternatives to Violence, which is an anger control group, and that program has just been limping along with very minimal sorts of funding. And it seems to me that if you could have a program like this, that we may be able to get dollars to very worthy programs like this particular Men's Anger Control Group that does very good work, and the coalition urges your support of this bill.
Thank you. Okay, William Apple.
My name is Bill Apple, and I represent Linfield College and also other independent colleges that have peace studies programs. It seems that this bill will be very compatible with our efforts educationally to deal with peace studies and nonviolence. And this program could support various types of public forums that we offer at independent colleges. Specifically, I know of George Fox, Linfield College, and Pacific University, and Willamette University, all of which have peace studies and nonviolent alternative type programs. Any questions?
If not, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
Peter Burgell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter Burgell. I serve as co-director of Citizen Action for Lasting Security, which is a statewide nuclear weapons freeze group. We strongly support this bill because we feel that the work that we do with nuclear weapons is inextricably bound up with the epidemic violence of our society. We feel like we need to start. The work that we do is sort of emergency work on the front lines of trying to allow the species to survive long enough so that we can come to some sort of a reasonable society, more mature society that can deal with violence from child abuse right on up to nuclear weapons and war and that sort of thing. I've also been a nonviolence trainer since 1968, and I'm quite amazed at the lack of knowledge, even with the people that I work with, who are probably much more interested in this subject than most people are, the lack of knowledge that people have about the whole subject of violence and especially nonviolence, the techniques of nonviolence. So both in my capacity as representative of Citizen Action for Lasting Security and also in my capacity as a nonviolence trainer, I feel that this particular bill has tremendous potential for helping this problem to be dealt with in a much more sensible manner. So we certainly urge your adoption.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Burgell? Representative Miller.
The group you represent, are
yes,
you funded by what tax contributions or those that are charitable contributions?
We're funded by our own fundraising activities and by contributions from individuals almost without exception. We get a few grants from organizations like the Mackenzie River Gathering and the Peace Development Fund and things like that, but that's a very small percentage of our, you know, of our income.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
I've been on another committee where there was an effort to create another check on box on the tax return form, and that was defeated because, well, for a variety of reasons, but a lot of people feel that once you start going down that road, you can just might as well create a little box for everybody's special interest. Is there any particular reason that this one should, say, rise above political checkoffs or the Audubon Society or somebody else?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Miller, I'd like to answer that two ways. One of them is, yes, I would like to answer that affirmatively. There is a reason, because I feel that if we don't deal with violence in this society, the society may not survive. And consequently, this issue is perhaps more important than a lot of other issues, simply because it's a survival issue from the point of view of the entire society and the entire planet. But from the other point of view, I would like to also say that I believe that the more of those checkoff boxes we put, the larger the giving is likely to be. And I don't see any particular competition. And studies that were introduced on the Senate side indicated that that is in fact true. I think Senator Hamby's prepared to speak about those. But some studies that have been done indicated that when people were given a wider choice of opportunities for giving, for charitable giving, and it wasn't all channeled into just United Way or something like that, that the giving actually went up, employee morale felt, you know, that people felt better about the giving that was asked of them, and in general the situation was an improvement all around. So I personally see very little opposition to a long string of checkoff opportunities.
Thank you. Further questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hamby, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you so much for taking me so quickly. For the record, Jeanette Hamby, Senate District 5. I promise to keep the hearing no longer than about 3 minutes, so I'm going to try to stick to it. I'm assuming that you have looked through the bill. You have had an opportunity to look at EMO's materials. Representative Miller's previous question is spoken to directly on EMO's materials regarding the options Oregonians currently have, if you look at my little handout, near the very bottom it shows 53,000 Oregonians donating to the non-game wildlife and 28,000 donating 112 to arts. And I guess the question that you face is the proposal before you this afternoon worthy of a spot beside wildlife and the arts? I hope your answer, of course, is yes. My opening testimony, because I know you can read faster than I can speak to it, shows what a violent nation indeed that we are, comparing the number of Americans killed in 1 year, 11,500 versus only 8 in Great Britain, etc. I really feel that Oregon does need a fund that would allow another option, a third option, for Oregonians to donate to. It will not cost the Revenue Department anything. It's had full support by many, many groups in the community. I don't know if those testifying previously spoke to Willamette University, George Fox, the number of universities that came forward and spoke in support of it, as well as other organized groups in the state. I'll respond to questions.
Any questions for Senator Hamby? If not, Representative Bunn?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 328 to the Revenue Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bunn moves that Senate Bill 328 be reported with a due pass recommendation and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Revenue. Is there further discussion?
Chairman.
Representative Bellamy.
Mr. Chairman, I will vote because I believe it's a revenue issue, but on the floor I will not support it as I have not supported any dollar checkoffs. I do not believe it's an appropriate way of creating special organizations.
That's true. Representative Bond.
I'd just like to say I support the bill, and I guess I disagree with Representative Bellamy. I frankly think it's an excellent way to allow citizens to become involved in a process through the expression and use of their own dollars.
Representative Miller?
I'll support the reference to revenue, but suggest that there are a host of other ways in order to encourage citizens to participate in worthy programs such as that are embodied in this vision.
Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Netsky?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's try 2648, or pardon me, Senate Bill 400. Next on our agenda, Senate Bill 400. Council, I recall that this was up Monday. There were some questions which we hoped that perhaps Representative Bunn and the proponents were going to be given an opportunity to sort of sit down together and see if they could resolve any questions. Maybe Ms. Paulson, we should ask you to come up. And Representative Bunn, would you like to indicate whether or not you've had that opportunity or where we stand on the bill at this point?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did have an opportunity to discuss, and I'm not sure. I suggested the possibility of a compromise or a minority-majority approach, and I guess I'd just be interested in hearing.
Excuse me for just a minute, Council.
There is a copy of the language that's proposed by Representative Bunn and Ms. Paulson before you. From our Legislative Council, SB 400A-4, it has Anita Paulson at the top. So it's just a half sheet, so you can look at the language for yourself.
Mr. Chairman, we do have agreement.
Okay. Ms. Paulson, would you like to outline the agreement that has been reached? And I assume it may be represented by these amendments. And if that's the case, then we'd be prepared to take a motion on the amendments. Ms. Paulson?
My name is Anita Paulson, Oregon Legal Services, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Representative Bunn and I met last night, and I hope that these amendments accurately reflect what we discussed. I worked them out with Legislative Council by phone this morning, and they appear to be satisfactory to me. What he suggested was at page 1, lines 13 and 14, instead of 1 year, we make it 2 years, so that if they had cohabited with each other within the immediate 2 years, they could qualify for an Abuse Prevention Act order. The second thing that he suggested was that we set up a procedure for the renewal for good cause shown of Family Abuse Prevention Act orders. And the language that Legislative Council came up with was adding a new section saying, for good cause shown, the court may renew an order under the Abuse Prevention Act, and the court may do so regardless of whether there's been a further act of abuse. And that takes care of a situation, for example, where someone has been in hiding for a year, and because they've successfully managed to escape, for example, they may still need the protection of the order, but they may not qualify because they haven't been together for a year. There hasn't been a fresh act of abuse. For example, another situation would be somebody that's just being released from jail or returning after an absence. I'm hoping that I got it right.
Bond?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the SB 400A-4 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Bunn moves the amendments to Senate Bill 400A, indicated as LC SB 400A-4, and bearing today's date. Is there further discussion? Is there objection to the motion or the amendments? Not their adopted. Representative Bunn?
Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bunn moves Senate Bill 400A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Bunn.
Excuse me, Ms. Paulson? I don't know if you, on the record, formally amended the 14 days to 21 days. That was already discussed.
Counsel, I believe, can you advise if that action was taken in subcommittee?
I believe the subcommittee adopted the amendment that would allow 21 days.
Well, just to make sure that we're absolutely clear, the chair would move as a friendly amendment to Representative Bunn's motion on the bill that where 14 days appears on line 9, page 2, that be amended to 21 days. Any objection to that amendment? If not, it's adopted. On the main motion, on the bill as amended to the floor, is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Betsy?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers? I'm a sponsor, so I'll give it a try. Okay, now let's try House Bill 2648. Counsel?
We heard this bill, I believe, on Monday, Mr. Chair, and there were some problems about the way it was written that arose between the district attorney and Mr. Austin, who was representing the bill. The committee asked them to get together and try and resolve those differences. I've been advised that those differences haven't been resolved, and I don't have any assurance to offer the committee in the way of amendments.
Okay, the amendments were adopted by the subcommittee, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, it's my understanding that the DAs have taken a position in strong opposition to the amendments, and it's come to my attention that there are other groups who have later had a chance to look at the amended bill and have also expressed their opposition. And I'm not sure if at this point it's necessary to take any further testimony. It would appear that in light of that opposition, notwithstanding very sincere efforts by the proponents of the bill to try to put it in a form that would be, if not acceptable, at least less objectionable, that they or we have not been able to achieve that result. And it would be my sense that the full committee is not prepared to support the bill, even as amended. And we're at the point, I'm afraid, where I just don't think that this session is going to see favorable action on the bill, even in its amended form. So, though we have not yet prepared our actual interim work plan, unless there's some strong objection, I would add this subject to the others which are listed for consideration during the interim. And for that reason, I think a motion to table would probably be appropriate. Representative Bellamy? Representative Bellamy moves to table House Bill 2648. It's a non-debatable motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Lund? Betsy?
I think you need my vote, guys.
Well, or we can call him.
Aye.
What was that?
That was a regretful aye. And I think you still put it down.
Miller?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Matters tabled. Okay, 3030. House Bill 3030.
All right, this is a bill that was brought to us by Representative Larry Keel. There are a number of people who have been convicted of crimes who sell their stories to the press and make considerable amounts of money. This legislation is designed to ensure that a victim of a compensable crime may recover damages or judgment from profits earned by the criminal for the sale of the story or of the criminal act. The committee heard testimony in favor of the bill. The committee amended the bill to strike the first two sections of the bill, remain the last three, sections three and four, which are the sections that provide for setting up a fund and hold any monies that were to go to someone who sold their story to the press in escrow for a period of 5 years so that victims could pursue their civil remedies against that particular money. The subcommittee voted on the deletion of section one and section two and moved the bill to the full committee review pass recommendation, and I don't have any indication that there's a fiscal impact.
Okay. It's my understanding, and you may cover this, Council, that Representative Hill did offer some amendments, but apparently those were not considered by the subcommittee. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the bill was amended to leave only sections 3 and 4, which have to do with the so-called sum of sand provisions.
Right.
Okay. Is there any discussion or question? Representative Bellamy.
And it is amended?
Yes.
It has been amended, yes. Not all the amendments, however, have been adopted. Representative Hill's amendments, I believe, briefly would... Council, can you explain those for just a moment? If the committee is prepared to adopt these amendments, the chair has no objection.
Basically, the amendments talk about setting up an escrow account if there are insufficient funds to meet all judgments presented by victims or their representatives and how to handle that account. And it extends the period of time for holding that fund from 2 years to 5 years. Those are the two things that the committee, those are the major things in the amendments that were offered by Representative Hill that weren't adopted by the committee.
Okay. Representative Phillips?
Those weren't adopted because of lack of time, not lack of interest. Is that correct?
Yes. I think in our haste to complete our agenda, it was an oversight that precluded consideration. I'm not aware of any objections expressed, and if the committee is comfortable with adopting those amendments at this time, Representative Phillips?
I'd like to move those amendments that establish the trust fund. Well, here I've got the number 3030-1 LC draft.
Okay. We are on House Bill 3030, Representative Hill's amended bill, so-called Son of Sam provisions, and Representative Phillips has moved adoption of amendments prepared by Legislative Council 3030-1, bearing the date 5/30/85, which were proposed by Representative Hill for the purpose of making some improvements to the bill. Is there further discussion on the motion on the amendments? Representative Miller.
Chairman, no, did we have any input from the Department of Justice as to whether or not they wanted to read everything that's being written over at the prison?
Not that I recall.
I don't recall any, Mr. Chair.
I'm getting kind of a pass signal here. Maybe.
What?
If you would like to ask anyone to respond, Representative Miller, we understand do have some representatives of the Department of Justice here. I'm not sure if they're intimately familiar with the bill, but.
Well, that's all right, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure they'll be given every opportunity to speak to that issue on the Senate side if they've not had a chance to prepare for today's hearing.
Well, assuming it passes, yeah.
Okay, is there further discussion on the motion on the amendments? Is there any objection to that motion? If not, the amendments are adopted. Mr. St. Bellamy?
Mr. Chair, I move to send House Bill 3030 to the floor as amended to pass.
Okay, Representative Bellamy moves House Bill 3030 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Betsy?
Aye.
Miller?
Oh.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted.
Chairman, I'll serve notice of a possible minority report.
Representative Miller serves notice of a possible minority report.
Representative Phillips, carry
that. Will?
Well, Hill will probably want to.
We'll probably ask Representative Hill if he'd like the honors on that. If there's some problem with that, we'll reconsider. We have three members who are testifying down in other committees, and a couple or three of the next bills I think are going to require some all members probably to be here for the discussion or purposes of amendments. There are some bills I think we can deal with in the absence of those who are excused. Let's try Senate Bill 186, please.
Chair.
Representative Kopetsky?
I may want to reconsider it some other time, just kind of serving notice to the committee to vote.
Okay. Representative Kopetsky served notice that he may wish to reconsider the vote on 3030 as a person who had voted on the prevailing side.
That, according to our rules, work the same way as it would on the floor, then?
I don't think it's really addressed as a rule. I just let folks know. Okay. That's all.
I don't think our rules speak specifically to an accelerated time or immediate reconsideration. So I, if necessary, will contact the clerk's office or advise if there's an inquiry as to what rule applies.
Well, I assume he means today.
Well, I think in the past, committees, practice in committees in the legislature has been that before the bill is turned into the desk, the committees can reconsider their action.
I think that's correct. I haven't spoken specifically with the chief clerk, but I think as long as the bill is within the possession of the committee, when notice has been served, that motion is appropriate and can be acted upon.
I'm not even, Mr. Chair, I don't think notice.
I'm not even sure that notice is necessary. By practice, in other cases, that notice is an absolute requirement and wouldn't necessarily feel bound to rule that it would be. So, any further questions before we take up 186? Council?
All right. This is a bill brought, recommended by the Department of Justice, as I recall. Currently, taxpayers appealing income taxes to the tax court must first pay the tax in controversy unless the judge determines such payment to be an undue hardship. Sometimes the hardship determination is not made until it's too late to pay the tax, and this bill gives the taxpayer an extra 30 days upon the judge's order in which to pay the disputed amount. This measure makes two changes in the Oregon tax court appeals provisions. Our taxpayer has appealed a tax imposed on net income. The bill would allow the judge to grant the taxpayer after 30 days to pay the disputed tax amount after the judge determines that such payment is not a hardship on that particular person. Secondly, it adds to the existing small claims division of the tax courts the settlement of disputes over taxes administered by the Department of Revenue for local taxing districts. The bill was not amended in the subcommittee. It was moved to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation, and there's no
fiscal
impact.
Mr.
Chairman. Representative Bunn. I would move Senate Bill 186A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bunn moves Senate Bill 186A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Question.
Representative Phillips.
Perhaps the council, if we give them, the taxpayer, 30 days to pay a disputed amount, how much time do they have now? If the judge rules that they owe it, do they have to pay right away?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And it actually gives the judge the opportunity to give them this automatically, too. The judge has the discretion to give them
this is after they have applied, ask for hardship, and denied.
Further question?
Okay.
Any further questions? Lieutenant Peterson, we're on 186 and the motion to the floor do pass. Clerk will call the roll.
Zellner?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Gretzky?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers?
I'll go.
Representative Bellamy.
I'll always let the lawyer in the committee do
it. No, I think this is one that's probably best if the non-attorney carries. Bellamy, and I know Judge Byers would be pleased and privileged to know you're going to be carrying his bill.
Get the wig back on.
Get the wig and the robe back on. Let's try 588, please.
This bill deals with adopting the new Uniform Loan Partnership Act to replace the old Loan Partnership Act.
He would ask the committee to consider preserving the mandatory minimum with respect to aggravated murder with respect to 17-year-olds. I submit to you that it is both fair and wise to impose increasing responsibility on individuals as they approach age 18. At age 18, persons become subject to the death penalty or the mandatory minimum for commission of aggravated murder under ORS 163.105. We therefore believe it is sound policy to impose on 17-year-olds a portion of that potential penalty for the same crime, particularly in light of the fact that the remand criteria in Section 1 of Senate Bill 414 selects for those juveniles who are the least treatable. So I'd simply ask if there are going to be significant changes in the bill that you consider that change. I would add one further comment with respect to the proposal by the ACLU to limit crimes for which 16 and 17-year-olds would be subject to remand to A and B felonies and I think 5C felonies. I'm concerned that this yet leaves out the kind of situation which we need to take into consideration, and that is the 17-and-a-half-year-old who commits one of those other Class C felonies or, say, a Class A misdemeanor, for example, Assault 4, who's already been to McLaren one or more times, but is perhaps on parole, who does not want to go back to McLaren, who sees themselves as an adult, sees themselves as beyond the programs of McLaren, and McLaren agrees. McLaren agrees that they're not appropriate and really would not benefit from being sent back to McLaren. In effect, I fear that passage of that amendment would leave us without any reasonable, available program or sentencing options for that individual. So I would support the comments that were made earlier that it comes late in the session and really deserves a great deal of consideration in a full legislative process. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions for any of the three witnesses who testified at this point?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riles.
I wanted to say if there were some statistical questions regarding relationships of amounts or numbers. Jim Huger is here from the justice system and, you know, can deal with any of the other. We went into great detail with those in the subcommittee, but for those Representative Burton, Representative Bellamy, and Representative Bunn, Jim Huger is here that has even more statistical information for you. But I did want to enter on the record that another concern that I have in working with this bill for 3 years is the lack of record keeping that we currently have in tracking what happens within our juvenile justice system versus arrests, remand, and where people go and what happens to them.
we need to do a lot more work in that area of having better statistical data about the juvenile justice system. We can answer a lot of your questions, but some of your very good questions that you ask, we can't answer because the data isn't kept that way. In some cases, isn't kept at all. It's another area of concern.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for our three witnesses? Okay, Keith, I guess my understanding was from prior testimony was that the ACLU amendment reflects what actually occurs in Multnomah County about 99% of the time, or maybe 95% of the time.
That's true, Representative Springer. And when Representative Peterson asked me the question in earlier hearings, it didn't occur to me until I was on the freeway home that I had responded to that, saying I didn't see that as a problem, but I neglected the situation that I've just described. The individual who's been to McLaren before, who's approaching age 18, and if we don't have the option of remand, we really do are left without any options, any reasonable options. So it's that type of individual that I'm concerned about with respect to the proposed ACLU amendment. There are a number of those cases every year in Multnomah County where we have individuals who've been to McLaren before and do not want to go back and may come in on one of these lesser crimes.
Okay. This is more a comment than a question. It's been discussed in subcommittee. Senator Riles, Mr. Attorney General Keith, I'm sure you're all aware we're going to have a bill on the floor, 2045, within the next day or two, which establishes a state policy, a substantial effort to reduce the population of McLaren and eventually phase out that facility altogether. And we are also presented with the fact that our remand rate here in the state of Oregon is one of the highest in the country. And so I think, speaking as a person who has worked with the ACLU on these amendments and who is concerned about the rate of remand in this state being far in excess of what I think it ought to be, and there are probably many, many reasons for that, how do you see us dealing now with the problem that the remand rate is too high and that we are faced with a policy decision that we are going to reduce the size of our state training schools? Anyone who wants to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, the rate of remand is too high in the state of Oregon. Those statistics are based on the current law of 16 and 17-year-olds, and I agree with that. That's why the criteria applies to all. So the question of overcrowding at McLaren and the relationship of the change there relates to 16 and 17-year-olds and the change you want to do there. Again, I'd like to refocus the committee's attention that the bill was on 14 and 15-year-olds, is now on 15-year-olds, and the number we're talking about are 4 to 5 people a year. So the effect of this bill on that problem is really negligible. Those 4 or 5 are not going to make that difference. If anything, the criteria in this bill is going to help reduce those 16 and 17-year-olds that are being remanded. So I think this bill fits right into the philosophy of what we're trying to do in the downgrading of McLaren, because I really don't think you're going to take juveniles of violent crime that are 15 years of age and turn them into some kind of a shelter care kind of a program. These are precisely the kinds of teenagers that need to be in the kinds of facilities that have lockup and the kinds of tight security that you don't get when we were talking about community-based, where we want the other people to be. So I do not see this in conflict with that philosophy at all.
Okay, let me recognize Representative Burton. Representative Burton.
Senator, what facilities?
I beg your pardon?
What facilities?
What facilities? Well, right now.
Where are you going to lock them up? We seem to have a shortage of that space right now. I'm just wondering where you're going to lock them up.
Remember, we're talking about 5 cases a year, probably. And of those 5 cases for those crimes, that they would be going to McLaren. And now, what's your question in relation to
I guess my question
that?
Is I,
if there isn't any McLaren, where will they go? Well, my question is, where will anyone go, whether they're 15-year-olds or anyone else? What are you going to do with them? this group of people that this bill addresses is not going to change that dilemma one way or the other.
So we're writing this for about five cases a year.
That's right. This applies about five cases a year.
May I also respond?
Go ahead, Keith.
It's not my understanding that the ability to send to a state training school is going to be closed out entirely. There are going to be secure custody bed spaces, but it's my understanding if they close McLaren, that's because they're going to combine the programs at McLaren and Hillcrest. So we will still have secure custody bed space there, admittedly at a substantially reduced number. But even in the most strongest expression of downsizing perspective, I think there's still going to be secure custody bed spaces on the state training school level.
Okay. Keith, let me ask you, on your proposed amendment, which I think all members have a copy of this, I hope, if I understand it correctly, you are asking that a minimum mandatory sentence, can you, just for my own knowledge and other members, restate what is the mandatory minimum sentence under ORS Chapter 163?
Yes. Representative Springer, I believe under subsection 1 of 163.105, the mandatory minimum is 30 years, and under subsection 2, it's 20 years.
Okay, and the language that I believe you suggested has indicated that be imposed. Is that the same as adult court, or is there discretion in the court?
If the person were 18, the adult court language provides that the jury, if upon a finding of guilty of aggravated murder, the jury would have an option of either the death penalty or the mandatory minimum. So what I've done is simply suggest that half of that be available for the 17-year-olds who are remanded, that the mandatory minimum be available. And that's why I use the word shall. I simply was looking to the adult statute.
Okay. And it's my understanding that the, maybe you can state it better. What would be the discretion of the parole board in this case? Is there any override provision?
I don't believe there is with respect to subsection 1, and I can't state with certainty with respect to subsection 2, but I don't believe there is an override mechanism.
Mr. Jones, can you help us out a little bit?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thomas Jones, Board of Parole. Under the aggravated murder now, the 30 years is mandatory. The inmate has the right on the 30 year to petition after the completion of 20 years for hearing to determine degree of rehabilitation and whether, in effect, a parole release date less than 30 years would then be established. I would assume that we're talking about a 15-year situation as we are here for those 17 and under. Was that what I understood, or 17 and older?
17 and older.
That, well, the 15 years is implied, the petition capability would come at the end of 10.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since we're all sitting up here together and Mr. Meisenheimer has been testifying with me, those amendments are not amendments that I have introduced or are suggesting. I think they are an example of what begins to happen when you start amending this bill. You're going to start moving another way on one side, tightening it up in one way as you move another way to loosen it. It's just a beginning of the whirlpool of action that can begin around this bill.
That's. I want to support that and just emphasize that that's why we view this as a compromise in certain respects to begin with.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kohlmeyer.
May I make it unanimous among the three of us here, and let me also say this in response to Representative Burton. Your question indicated that perhaps it's a small number of cases that are being involved, and in fact that is conceded. But reflecting on 6 years in the legislative process and now nearly five as Attorney General and watching the criminal justice system through all of that process, it's become my strong impression that the system is known more by its failures than by its successes, and that whenever a committee of the legislature can do something to prevent the possibility of those failures, because they are spectacular failures, that it will be doing a very great deal to protect the integrity of the criminal justice system. This bill deals with a problem that is an example of the spectacular failure of our juvenile justice system, which has ripple effects on the credibility of the criminal justice system as a whole. And that is because you have a small group of offenders who are violent, who are brutal, who victimize other people, and who are not amenable to treatment under the ordinary circumstances of our system. They must be dealt with. This is a reasonable approach. I would strongly urge the committee, as has Senator Riles, not to expand the dimensions of what is targeted as a bill to deal with that spectacular failure into a cure-all that may create other problems that are unanticipated, but probably nonetheless predictable.
Okay, are there further questions to the witnesses on the bill or to Mr. Meisenheimer on his amendment? If not, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We have now distributed copies of the amendments, which I've asked to be prepared, and I'd like to ask Ms. Burton to come forward very briefly to just review with the full committee these amendments. These are 414A-12, which bear today's date. The other set of amendments are -11, and those are conflict amendments about which I don't believe there's any controversy suggested. Ms. Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon, representing the ACLU of Oregon. These amendments do three things. They formalize the action taken by the subcommittee in changing the bottom age from 14 to 15. That's an action that's already been taken by the subcommittee. It then would, for 16 and 17 year olds, limit the offenses for which such juveniles could be remanded to Class A and Class B felonies and to Phi C felonies, ones that seemed serious and to involve personal injury. The third amendment is on the first page, and it speaks to an issue raised by the Juvenile Rights Project that's this situation. Under the bill as it stands, if a 15-year-old is remanded on one of the enumerated offenses, and in that same transaction allegedly committed several other offenses as well, all of the offenses go to adult court with that child for trial and disposition. If it should turn out that the child is not convicted on that offense that was the basis for remand, the manslaughter, for instance, then under the present bill, the child would stay in adult court and be sentenced as an adult on those somewhat less serious offenses. These amendments, this was proposed by the Juvenile Rights Project, would bring that child for sentencing back to the juvenile court if that child was not convicted on the quite serious offense that led to his remand in the first place. And Mr. Chairman, on that particular amendment, which is lines 17 through 23, these were amendments drafted this morning by legislative counsel. As he and I went over them, there are some technical problems with them. So if the committee was interested in that particular option, then I would suggest they adopt it in concept form only.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
If in that case the person was not found guilty of the one offense, was found guilty of the smaller offenses, even though it was in adult court, wouldn't they still be sentenced to McLaren? They're not going to go to adult jail under those circumstances, even though they're sentenced in adult court, are they?
That's correct, Representative Bellamy. They would go to McLaren initially, and then when the juvenile reached his 16th birthday, as I understand the bill, it would be CSD's option. The child might be retained there at McLaren, might be sent to OSCI. In any event, the sentencing would be under the adult system for the periods of time provided under the adult criminal law, and that conviction would be treated as a criminal conviction as an adult.
I guess my question would be, what difference does it make at that point if the person is in the court, they have gone through one set of circumstances and been found not guilty? What difference does it matter whether it's the juvenile judge or the adult judge that actually imposes the rest of the sentence.
There are two, Representative Bellamy. One has to do with the maximum time of the sentence. If the person is sentenced within the juvenile court, the maximum time of jurisdiction under juvenile court disposition is to the juvenile's 21st birthday, so that would set a lid. And then for that matter, if one is sentenced as a juvenile, as I understand it, at least for 16 and 17-year-olds, they must be kept at McLaren. It would be optional in the case of an adult. So there's some differences like that. Secondly, there are somewhat different dispositional alternatives and treatment options available to adult and juvenile court, and I'm not familiar with all the details of that, so I suppose I would focus on the first.
Representative
Bellamy.
One final question. Would this sort of situation ever happen, or would it most likely happen that the person would be tried in adult court for the manslaughter and then would be tried in the juvenile court for the rest of the convictions?
Representative Bellamy, under the bill, and it's on page 2, lines 9 through 14 generally, it provides, and specifically in lines 12 through 14 and 13 through 14, that if the child is found upon, first of all, it gets remanded on all of them. And secondly, it provides if the child is found not to have committed the crime designated in this sentence, the finding doesn't affect the fact of remand, which means that the rest of the rest of the matter stays there. But that section above that doesn't require, it says the person may be tried, this is in line 12, may be tried as an adult on all offenses arising out of the same act or transaction. What the Juvenile Rights Project was concerned about, Representative Bellamy, was this. There is, as you may well know, no probable cause hearing in juvenile court as to whether or not the juvenile probably committed the offenses with which they were charged. And the Juvenile Rights Project was concerned that youngster might have been involved in a situation and DA simply draws up the list of charges and includes one that is ultimately found, in fact the very serious one that qualifies the child for remand, found not to be so. And we're concerned, Rights Project is concerned about that possible prosecutor overcharging to get the kid into adult court.
Further question, Representative Bellamy? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Claudia, one of the things that we hear about, one of the actual criticisms that we hear about juvenile justice is that juveniles, in fact, do not have as many rights as adults have. And I guess what I want to clear up with you is that, is it really so bad that the juvenile will be tried in the adult system with all of the rights and protections that would be accorded to an adult?
Representative Hill, there are, from the juvenile's point of view, some substantial advantages being tried as an adult. When I was in practice, and at this point that was quite a while ago, because I've been teaching for, I think, 14 years now, some of my practice was in juvenile court, and with rare exception, I preferred, when it was a matter of dispute, that the youngster stay there for two reasons. One, I was concerned about the confidentiality and expungibility of that record. Certainly, locking someone up is a very serious matter. I think any of us can, maybe by trying hard, imagine what it would be like to first of all, commit an offense like that, and then lose a couple of years of your life behind bars. On the other hand, when that's done, it's done. And an adult criminal record is after that time is served and one's debt is paid, it is still a substantial disadvantage for the rest of that person's life in terms of entering various trades and professions, in terms of employment discrimination. So for the record, and for the youngster to have a chance as an adult at a fresh start, if in fact that kid has changed, was probably the primary reason I wanted to keep my clients in juvenile court if I could. Then secondly, for the more serious offenses, not for the less serious ones, but for the more serious ones, particularly the kinds that we're talking about here for the 15-year-olds, the potential sentences are quite a bit longer. And simply as an advocate for the child, I was interested in avoiding that possibility.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, are there further questions from Ms. Burton? Let me ask, Claudia, did you get a chance to listen to Mr. Meisenheimer's amendment?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair.
Could you state briefly your response or position on that amendment?
The first one or the second one?
The language which would be added to Section 9 to provide that a mandatory minimum sentence shall be imposed for the person who is 17 years of age at the time of the offense.
Mr. Chair, we would oppose that. ACLU across the board opposes mandatory minimum sentences. And sentences, and I would feel, and I think the organization would feel the same, that particularly if you are talking about a mandatory minimum sentence of this length time for a very serious matter, for sure, done when a person was 17, that I think does not take into account substantial changes that may or may not, but may occur between the time that a juvenile of 17 reaches the age of 30, say, or 35, or 45. So we would be opposed to that.
Okay. Are there further questions for Ms. Burton? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's deal with the conflict amendments first. Those have been distributed to members. They're LC 414-11, 612-85, and are intended to deal with the situation if House Bill 2046, which has been passed by this chamber, becomes law. Are there any questions? Representative Bellamy moves adoption of the conflict amendments. Is there further discussion? Any objection to those amendments? If not, they're adopted. The chair would move adoption of the LC amendments 414A-12 bearing the date 6/12/85, identified and spoken in favor of by the ACLU, and would to recognize the fact that down in the language on line 17 through 23, where it may be necessary for LC to rewrite that language to correct any problems in their initial draft, would incorporate that recommendation and then instruction to LC. Is there further discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hill.
Mr. Chairman, the section of the amendments, subsection 4, the ones that are outlined on lines 17 through 23, speaking for myself, I would concur with those amendments, but as to the other amendments on limiting remand to those five C felonies and the A and B, Chairman, we have my concern in that situation, as I mentioned in subcommittee, is that if you have a juvenile who has a record that indicates that they are in fact the type of person that we would like to incarcerate under this legislation, that we should be in a position to convict that person and appropriately sentence them regardless of what the offense might be. What this does is basically would prevent, and in certain circumstances, quite often when you actually catch someone and convict them, they have done many things other than the actual offense that they are being tried for. But if their past record indicates that they deserve harsh treatment, they should receive it despite the fact that the conviction that they are, what they've been charged with is a minor offense. So in that respect, I have to oppose the motions in toto.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on the amendments 414A-12.
Bellamy?
No.
Bunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Hill?
No.
Kopetsky?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Amendments are adopted. Are there any further motions on any amendments, or we deal with the motion on the main bill?
Mr.
Chairman? Rep. Miller.
Did you deal with the one submitted by the Multnomah County District Attorney?
No, that has been distributed and it's been discussed, and the chair would...
I'd move that amendment.
Thank you. Rep. Miller moves the amendment suggested and prepared on behalf of Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, which has been distributed to all members. It's not in LC form, but I think is clear enough. Are there any questions about the nature of the amendment? Rep. St. Peters.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you reiterate briefly for me just exactly what that amendment does?
Keith, why don't I ask you to speak to your own amendment briefly?
Thank you. For the record, Keith Gleisenheim, Deputy District Attorney. Under existing law, 18-year-olds are subject to the death penalty or to a mandatory minimum sentence for aggravated murder under 163, 105, 102. This would apply that portion of the aggravated murder statute to 17-year-olds, not the death penalty, but the mandatory minimum for aggravated murder to a person who is 17 at the time of committing the offense.
Thank you.
Okay. Further question? Rep. St. Burton.
I just want to, this doesn't in any way conflict with the amendments we just adopted.
I don't believe so.
Not a conflict in the sense that there would be any difficulty, I believe, with the interpretation of the law. It may be argued that the policy issues might be somewhat counter, but I don't think in the sense that you've suggested, Rep. St. Burton. Okay, any further questions regarding the nature of the amendment? Stand at ease for a moment here if there's need for clarification.
Mr. Jones was questioning whether the amendment would allow the petition process